So this is what I'm going to be covering in the workshop today. So first, we're going to have the first section, which is I'm going to give a presentation, share some of the ideas that you may not have seen in the Learning Upstairs program or in the bootcamp. And what I'm going to cover is some of these sort of advanced methods. So these are less tactical and more strategic. So a lot of the tactics I cover, like metaphors, visualization, Feynman technique, active reading, flow-based note-taking, those are for very specific contexts. How do you read faster? How do you remember an idea better? These are more general strategies. So how do you approach learning an entire class? And so I'll be talking about the MIT method, which is the method that I used to learn all of the classes I used, I went through during the MIT challenge. I will also talk about another technique, which is what I call Feynman scaffolds, and they're basically a way of incorporating a lot of different ideas together. So if you want to understand when you should be using metaphors, when you should be using visualization, the Feynman scaffold will give you a sense of how to do that better. And finally, I'm going to cover rapid self-education, because self-education both has more pitfalls, but it also has more advantages than regular education. You also have some opportunities that you can't do in a regular schooling process, but at the same time there's some pitfalls that is probably the reason a lot of self-education efforts fail. So I'll be going over how to avoid those pitfalls while also taking advantage of some of the opportunities you have if you're teaching yourself. And then finally, I'm hoping we'll have about a half hour of question and answer and live coaching. So in case you just missed it when I was explaining it earlier, the hand raising button is if you have a microphone and when we get to the interactive portion, you want me to bring you on the line and you can speak into your microphone and we can deal with your questions one-on-one, then you can do that. Or if you just have a question that you want me to respond to, you can just type it into the chat and I can also receive questions that way via text. So let's get started, you guys. So the MIT method is what I call the overall strategy that I used for learning all of the classes during the MIT challenge. And basically, it breaks down the whole learning process of going from never seeing any of the content before to being able to successfully pass exams, successfully use the knowledge in a real application. It breaks it down to three stages: coverage, practice, and then insight. And so The three phases really, I would say, accomplish the same kind of goals as the five-step system that I talk about briefly in Learn More, Study Less. It's just a different way of looking at it. So it's not a contradictory model, it's just a different way of looking at the problem. And the first stage is coverage. Now, coverage is basically getting access to the information or acquiring the information. So in an academic setting, that's often watching lectures, reading textbooks. That's how you acquire the information. But it doesn't have to be that. It could also mean if you are in a live demonstration in a class and they are doing a live demo of whatever you want to learn, or you're going through an online tutorial of some programming concept. Those are also ways to cover the idea. Now, the main point I have to make is that coverage is less important than many people make it out to be. A lot of people make coverage the majority of their learning effort, so they spend most of their time on coverage, and then the weakness is that they don't do the other two phases, which, in my opinion, are far more important for successfully using the ideas. So what I try to recommend is figuring out what's a way that you can cover the material so that you are paying attention, that you are focusing on it in a deep way, but that you're not spending tons and tons of time rereading things, rereading textbooks, rewatching lectures, that you watch the information, you get as much as you can out of it, and then you move on to the other two phases, and then only go back when you've actually found something that you've missed. The next phase is the practice phase. And practice is sort of obvious in the context of mathematics or computer science or physics, where you have to do practice problems or you have to do actual practical projects. But how do you practice history or how do you practice English literature? The main way I want to define practice, and I think the main way that it makes sense, is think of practice as getting feedback on what you know. So a lot of times when you are learning something, you're just passively ingesting the material. So you are listening to something, and even if it's engaging, you are just saying, yes, yes, you're nodding along, you are nodding along with what is happening. But you're not necessarily getting feedback on whether or not you actually understood what was presented and whether or not you understood it in a deep or a useful way. So practice is all about trying to figure out what it is that you actually know and what it is that you don't know. So practice problems, practical projects. For those of you who are fans of Cal Newport, I strongly recommend for non-technical classes his quiz and recall method. So basically what that is you test yourself, do you understand the big ideas from sections? So you, when you're going through the coverage phase, you write out the big ideas of each section you're covering, and then you do a quiz and recall. So you sort of give yourself the information, then you test yourself to see whether you know it. So the quiz and recall is a way that you can take the practice, the feedback angle, and apply it to non-technical classes. If you're in a class that requires remembering a lot of trivia, so medical classes, legal classes, or anything where you just have to remember a lot, then flashcards are another way that you can consider doing practice. I don't think that it's ever bad to do too much practice, but practice does take a lot of time. And so there's no such thing as overdoing practice. There's no such thing as overdoing practice problems or overdoing quiz and recall. However, what I try to teach is not just what is the best way to do it, but also what's a way that you can do it faster. And so when I was doing the MIT Challenge, for example, I wouldn't have time to spend 3 solid weeks doing practice problems. Maybe I'd only have a couple days. So how could I use that limited amount of time in the most efficient way possible? And so what I found is that just doing practice alone, while it can eventually get you the results, sometimes it's a bit slower. Sometimes you have to go through 10 questions before you get the real key insight that you could have gotten through using other techniques. Or, for example, if you are trying to remember something and you're remembering it just using flashcards, that's going to be a lot less efficient than using metaphors, visualization, or some kind of mnemonic technique to make the idea stick a little bit better. So the next phase is insight. And so insight is really, if you think about the three phases, it's kind of like a pyramid. The coverage, you're covering all the material. Practice, you are practicing the applicable material. So whatever is most important, whatever is going to be on the exam, that's what you are practicing. And then finally, insight is once you figure out what your weaknesses are. So once you figure out, after having gone through the practice questions, you know, I'm really bad at RLC circuits, or I'm really bad at differential equations, I'm bad with some particular aspect, then you can go back and you can do a Feynman technique. You can, Feynman's, I would say, are really good for math, physics, technical classes where you really have to understand an idea well. Metaphors and visualizations are good for things that are sort of in between, that you need to understand, but that they're not too difficult, they just might be difficult to remember. And for things that you have to remember, and I strain that this is not useful most of the time, I've done probably about 50 plus undergraduate courses, either, you know, self-education or in actual university, and I would say I've only had cause to use mnemonics in one or two of them. But in some cases, mnemonics could count as this. So if you're in medical classes where you have to memorize tons of definitions, tons of vocabulary words, then using mnemonics could be a form of, okay, I'm having a really hard time remembering all this terminology in this particular unit. I understand it, but I'm having trouble remembering it. And I know that because I was doing flashcards, I was doing quiz and recall, and I wasn't getting the answers I want. I wasn't getting the results I want. So you can use mnemonics as a way to improve that. So most of the techniques that I teach in this course are about doing this phase. Practice problems and coverage, you can do them more efficiently, but they're fairly straightforward. But this insight really sits at the top of the pyramid. And if you learn how to do it very well, then you can streamline a lot of the other processes because you gain more efficiency higher up on the pyramid than lower down in the pyramid. So just covering and recovering material is really inefficient. Doing practice problem over practice problem is certainly more efficient, but sometimes it's still too slow. And doing the insight technique on top of the practice problems, on top of the coverage, is, in my opinion, the best way to learn material quickly. So this brings into what I was discussing earlier, the Feynman scaffold. And so this is really an answer to two questions. The first question is, when do I use metaphors? So if you've been following the material in the course, one of the techniques I bring up is metaphors. So that's also similar to, I believe it was day 2 material from the boot camp. So for those of you that followed the boot camp, you were probably used to, well, how do I remember ideas better? And one of the answers is you want to use metaphors, you want to use visualizations, you want to make the ideas vivid and connected to things you already understand. And in general, doing more metaphors is always better. So if you have the time and if you have the inclination, if you make tons of metaphors all over the place, you will probably understand the ideas better, or at least remember them better than you would if you do not do them. Unfortunately, maybe you don't have time to do metaphors for every single topic in your class. That was certainly the case when I was doing my classes, and it's probably the case for you. Time is limited. How do you use metaphors in the most efficient way possible? So I don't suggest just doing them randomly on every single subject, although that could be a way that you gain practice with the technique, as I suggest in the 30-day trial. But the best and most efficient way I found is to use them as part of the Feynman technique. So basically the way it works is you start a Feynman paper, so you get a blank piece of paper, you say understanding voltage or understanding the Renaissance, and you start explaining it as if you're teaching it to someone else. And in particular, you pay attention to when your explanation is too similar to the instructor's explanation, meaning you're not really putting it as much in your own words, or it is too complicated, or it is too abstract. And those are opportunities for when you should have this feeling, this is kind of complicated, I might not remember this, let's come up with a metaphor, let's come up with a diagram, let's come up with a visualization to try to tie it down to something concrete. So that's what I suggest you do. So if you're not sure where you use these techniques, then always default to just using them within the Feynman technique, because that's a very guided process. If you're using this again on, you should be using the Feynman technique specifically on the ideas that you've identified through both your coverage and your practice as being weak spots or areas that you want to really focus on. And so that way you know that all of your effort and this energy is going towards the things where it matters most. Okay, now let's talk about rapid self-education. So, in my opinion, a lot of self-education attempts fail. I know that a lot of people are self-educated, and you can definitely do it successfully, but there's a lot of pitfalls. For the first part, often you don't have a curriculum. So I think one of the major reasons a lot of people never attempted anything like the MIT Challenge is because a question I often get is, well, how did you know which classes to take? Now, it's not impossible to build a curriculum, but it does take more work. And I think a lot of people who are used to traditional schooling environments are used to that structure just being given to them. And so they have no experience creating that structure for themselves. And when you don't have any experience creating that structure, you tend to just kind of peck at different classes. And this creates the problem of whenever you encounter a real obstacle, you get stuck and then you maybe give up. If you have a structure, then when you encounter an obstacle, you will know at least, well, but I should be able to handle this. This is a manageable problem, and you can push through it. So that's a big part. Second problem is that often there isn't evaluation criteria, or there is evaluation criteria, but you're not actually using it. And so that's a big problem. As I said when I was discussing the MIT method, practice and insight are huge parts of learning. So if you are just doing the coverage part and you're not doing practice and insight, then I don't really think you can claim that you've done a particular class. If you're only doing just watching the lectures, I don't think you can claim that, because the thing that I've learned is that it is very misleading to just do a bunch of lectures before realizing, oh wait, I don't actually fully understand a lot of these ideas. And finally, often in self-education, there isn't a real commitment. And so in your situation, you might have a skill that you want to learn, which isn't too critical for your life. So in which case, maybe you don't want to spend tons of time invested in it. And I understand that. But at the same time, if a lot of people would like to do some self-education in a particular area, but they hold themselves back because they don't actually ever carve away a certain amount of time to devote to the project. And so I think commitment is also a huge part of it. So let's go over these few details in a little bit more detail so that you can sort of see how you can fix these problems. So the first part is building a curriculum. Now, when I was doing the MIT Challenge, when I was preparing for it, I spent over 2 months actually just preparing the curriculum. Now, that might sound excessive, and in some ways it was, because I was trying to make sure I had all my research done as thoroughly as possible before I made this big announcement that I was going to finish this. But I do think, nonetheless, it was very useful for me to spend a lot of time thinking about how I was actually going to go through the program, what classes I was going to take, what the general approach I was going to use, because the preparation built my enthusiasm for the project. So in going through the curriculum, I would look through things and say, yeah, I really want to take that class. That class looks really interesting. I really am interested in artificial intelligence or networking or computer graphics. And so this built enthusiasm for the project, and I think that was a big part of how I had some early momentum. And finally, it structured my progress so that when I did encounter obstacles, I had something to fall back on. And I think that's a big part, because inevitably when you're learning anything, you will encounter obstacles that will make you want to quit. And if you have a structured curriculum, it will be less likely that you will just give up. So I don't recommend spending 2 months. Probably you don't want to try to do an entire degree versus worth of self-education. Maybe you just want to do 4 or 5 classes. But nonetheless, I think that it makes a lot of sense to spend just a day, just spend, you know, an afternoon on your weekend planning out how you're going to take on a particular self-education project. Because I think that planning helps you at least think through some of the problems that you might encounter, so you have a little bit more grit going into the actual challenge. So where do you get classes? So if you are interested in teaching yourself something, where do you get the knowledge for it? Now, there's new platforms. edX and Coursera are great. I'm currently finishing up a machine learning class from Coursera, and they're great classes, really high quality videos that are easy to watch online. They tend to be, I would say, very well suited for the self-education dimension. However, there aren't that many classes for them yet. There are quite a few, so if you go on those platforms and you see something that interests you, that's great, but I would say MIT's open courseware still wins on volume. There are thousands of courses there, even if the quality is sometimes a little bit more hit and miss. So sometimes with an MIT open courseware class, you might only have some of the assignments, you might only have some of the material, and you might not have lecture videos. You might not get everything. But what I'm going to try to explain to you today is that even when the course is missing a lot of material, often it's still very doable to do the entire course or to learn all the material in the course if you are interested in the subject. Another resource that you have, which almost nobody knows about, but was absolutely essential for me in finishing the MIT challenge, is that many universities have public access classes. So they're not actually open courseware. They're not intended for people outside the university, but they have no restricted access, and you can actually just access the material on them. So I will just briefly, show you this right now So what you can do right now is look at Stellar. So Stellar is the one that MIT uses. And if you just Google Stellar and then whatever department it is that you're looking for. So with here, the Department for Electrical Engineering and Computer Science is 6. So I just click on this. And you can look here and you can see all of these classes that are for MIT students, but many of them, as you can see, are public. So if I wanted to take a class in interactive computer theorem proving, I can almost guarantee that such a class does not exist certainly in Coursera or edX, and it probably doesn't exist in OpenCourseWare either, but I can go into this class and I can look at some of the material so that I can see online drafts of the textbook, I can look at some of the finals, I can get some of the information. So I wouldn't say that's the right option for everyone, but it is a good option if you are looking for more material and there's this topic that you really want to learn. Also, try to figure out where the universities are putting their classes online for their own students, and often you can access a lot of the notes and material for those classes. So how do you learn without lectures? And this is, I think, a very important skill to have, because a lot of the classes that you might want to take if you're doing self-education do not have lecture videos, at least right now. You know, maybe this will be redundant 3-5 years from now when edX and Coursera cover all the topics, but I would say right now there are a lot of things that you might want to learn which are hard to find lecture videos for. So technical topics and high school and freshman math, they have tons of videos, so you don't have to worry about it. But if you want to learn a lot of other topics, they just don't have the material yet. However, as I said, OpenCourseWare has been around for 10 years, so it has tons of classes, and that's just MIT. There's also Harvard, Yale, Berkeley. There's a bunch of other universities that have these kind of open classes, but they might not have lecture videos. So my first recommendation is that if the class suggests a textbook and it has reading assignments, just buy the textbook. You can go on Amazon and look for the edition and often buy it for like $20 or $30. I bought many textbooks during the MIT Challenge for under $20. So there are some times when you're used to taking university, you're doing new editions and they're not used, they're new books and you're spending $100 to $200. Whereas when you're doing open courseware, often the course was taught 5-6 years ago. It's still valid, but it was taught 5-6 years ago. And so it uses an older edition of the course. So you can buy it on Amazon used for, in some cases, less than $10. And that way you can read through it and you can, I would say, learn the course almost as well, if not better, than when it has lecture videos. So when a lot of people look through MIT's OpenCourseWare, they see that only some of the classes have lecture videos and they immediately dismiss all the ones that don't. And I want to just say, don't do that, because it's not actually that difficult to learn a class if you can get the textbook. Even without the textbook, a lot of classes are still doable if they have substantial course notes. So many of the classes I did not have textbook or lecture videos, but the course notes were practically a textbook. You could read through them. They were not just PowerPoint slides. You could read through them. They had significant detail and they explained the ideas, I would say, sufficiently well that I could at least start working on the practice problems. And I think the big lesson of this is learn what you want to learn, not just whatever is available. And I think that that's the real power of self-education, is you get to tailor what you want to learn specifically to what interests you. And you don't have to just sort of accept that, oh, well, I don't know what's out there, so I'll just take this class that doesn't really interest me as much. Learn what you want to learn, and I think that that's the big part of being able to use this hidden material, all the open courseware material, and learn without lectures, that you can learn things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to learn, at least at this stage of online education. So the next step is evaluating yourself, and as I mentioned with the MIT method, feedback is critical for progress. So if you are doing a class and you are not evaluating yourself in some way, then I don't think you can really count it as a class that you're doing. So try to find some way to evaluate yourself. I already spoke about ways you can do that. So assignments with solutions, projects with objective criteria are really good ways, but also even quiz and recall, flashcard style systems, anything that you can get feedback on how well you understand the idea. Even doing things like the Feynman technique and the five-year-old method can give you some feedback. It's not the same as the feedback that you would get compared to doing the course in an exam setting, but it is still pretty good if you don't have that. So make sure that evaluation and feedback is part of your learning progress. That's absolutely critical. And finally, set up a dedicated learning time. So if you are interested in learning something, if it is important to you, set up a dedicated time to learn it. I know a lot of people just get, it'd be nice to learn X or it'd be nice to learn Y, but they never actually structure their progress and they never actually commit to that structure. So as soon as they hit the first obstacle, the first little bit of difficulty, then they give up. And I think if you're going to give up at the first little bit of difficulty, you're not going to achieve that much in terms of self-education, because there's always going to be little things that provide you just momentary discomfort or momentary confusion. And if you give up the first time you encounter one of those, then you're going to get stuck for good on a lot of problems. So make concrete goals, and that also goes back to doing the curriculum. If you design a curriculum thoroughly, then you have a really concrete goal to work towards. And I would even say slow but committed is better than fast but not committed. So trying to do tons, but you don't have any structuring, you don't have any commitment, that's going to die off as soon as your motivation dies off. Whereas if you say, you know what, just Mondays, I'm going to set aside 3 hours to learn this new skill I want to learn, and you just commit to every Monday you're going to spend those 3 hours, then I would say that's a lot better in the long term than just, I'm really interested in learning all these things, I'm going to learn it when I have time, and then as soon as you encounter difficulty, you give up or you move on to the next thing that interests you. So I think that is also a big part. Slow and committed is often better than fast but not committed. So that was very quickly the presentation component of it, and now I'm going to be going through and trying to answer some of your questions, and then I'll start by just answering some of the questions that you've already written and that you can write now in the text pane, and then hopefully near the end we can also do some live coaching with people who have microphones. So let's go through some of the questions that you have already asked. So Joseph Chu says, I tried your day one of the boot camp of working in short bursts and constraining your working hours, but as a student I find that things always come up during the day and I don't have time to get all my work done within my working hours. Can you address this? So my response to Joseph would be that this is a very common problem. I think that it's about having deep focus for your work and having blocks of time where you can focus without interruptions. And so him saying, I find that things always come up, they do always come up, but this really goes back to, and you know, it's an older book and something maybe you've heard before, but I think it's still very relevant today. Stephen Covey, when he was talking about, there's four quadrants of activities. There's things that are urgent and important, there's things that are urgent and not important, there's things that are important but not urgent, and there's things that are not important and not urgent. So there's sort of a grid of four cells on two dimensions, urgency and importance. And I would say that a lot of activities that sort of, things that come up during the day are the things that are urgent, but they're not always important. And so it takes discipline to not only say, I'm not going to respond to this right now, but to work on the things that are important even though they're not urgent. So one way to do that is just to set aside certain hours. Maybe they're more restricted than the hours that you have right now. Maybe you say, well, I can only commit to 4 hours without any distractions, and then maybe I have another 4 hours where I can do some work, but I also allow myself to engage with these other distractions. But if you just say 4 hours a day, turn off the cell phone, turn off the computer, you close yourself away, you only work on the things you need to work on, nobody can reach you, and you just tell people, look, I need this time for me. If it's extremely important, then you know you can come in with your hair on fire if you need to, but otherwise, I need to be in privacy or I need to be in silence to work on this. That's very important. And I think that if you let those sort of urgent activities dictate your time always, then it's going to be very hard to use a system like Fixed Schedule. So Ryan Clausen is asking, could you answer how to make metaphors and connections concerning math equations? So I suggest, first of all, using the Feynman technique on math equations, because generally the way you will remember a math equation better is by really deeply understanding it. And often making a metaphor or a connection is really hard with a math equation if you don't fully understand it. So that would be the way I'd start. I would start by just trying to really thoroughly explain and understand the equation as a starting point. And then only once you've really started to understand it yourself, you'll be able to see these connections. So I did this with myself with the Fourier transform. I had to go through it several times, several Feynmans, before I realized, oh, this is actually what it's doing. I didn't realize that, oh, it's turning between color, or is turning between electromagnetic waves and color, is turning between pressure waves and pitch, or is turning between one domain to another. I didn't really understand how the equation worked, and because I didn't understand it, I wasn't able to make good metaphors. I wasn't able to think of them. So if you aren't able to think of good metaphors or analogies for a topic, that would be my first bet, is that you don't fully understand the deep structure yet, and so use the Feynman technique to try to get at that. Gilbert Yang writes, how often do you revisit old material you studied in order to ensure you still remember all that you've learned? Do you test yourself? If so, do you expect yourself to be as knowledgeable in the subject as you were when you were actively studying it? So I think this is an unfortunate problem that comes up a lot, and I don't know a really good way around it. Memory atrophies, learning atrophies. If you do not use skills, they will go away. If you do not actively use information, it will fade away and you will not learn it as well as when you were actively studying it. I believe if you learn things holistically, that means is you make deep representations and you connect it to all sorts of ideas outside of that field, you greatly increase the longevity of the information you have. And the reason for that is that if you have a really connected understanding, so I understand a particular mathematical concept, but I understand it in all these other domains that I regularly encounter, then I can regularly link back to that mathematical concept and understand it. If I only understood it in this very narrow context, then I would probably forget about it. So The connected representations and the holistic learning that we talk about in the program, I think, is a good way to combat that. But ultimately, there's no silver bullet that you can escape it. I think that the main thing that I try to stress is that relearning tends to be easier than learning for the first time. So if you learn something and you feel, you know, I've forgotten a lot of that, just remind yourself that, especially if you learned it in the way we're describing, relearning will be a lot easier. I did have a few classes that I had not done any material on it for years after studying it the first time when I was doing it through the MIT Challenge. And I did have to relearn it a little bit, but it was so much easier relearning it than to learn new ideas for the first time. And so that's also the way I kind of put it back, is I don't try to think of it, you know, having all the knowledge that I've ever obtained in this perfectly pristine state, but just say that, you know, because I've learned that in the past, if I need to use it again, I can relearn it in a third of the time. I can relearn it in a quarter of the time, maybe. So that's a big part of it as well. And often when you are finding yourself saying, well, I've completely forgotten this, I haven't learned it well, it's probably because you didn't learn it as deeply enough the first time. So Tim Sun writes, when you're doing the initial coverage part of a class and get the ideas, you aren't quite clear how to decide whether you say keep watching the lecture and hope you learn it better or dig in and try to figure it out now. So that's an interesting question. In general, I found that the level I wanted to be at when I was watching lectures or reading textbooks is that I can nod along. So this is sort of like a pace where I feel like I understand what they're saying. If I don't feel like I understand what they're saying, then it's probably best to stop and understand it. Because especially with classes that build on each other, so if you're doing a calculus class, if you're really lost after the first lecture, like you have no idea what they're talking about, then you're just wasting time listening to it. So I would say the pace that you want to be at is you don't necessarily have to have mastered it to cover the material, but you have to be at least at a level of fluency where when they explain something, you can say, oh yeah, that makes sense, or oh yeah, I get that. If you completely don't understand it, then you need to sort of take a step back and work on the material. So that sort of nod along pace is roughly where I would draw that line. As a marine biology major, many of my classes require understanding lots of fairly straightforward concepts and terminology. My new goal is to review and learn the material right away because I have noticed that come exam time, I'm scrambling to prepare essay format exams. How should I approach this? Okay, so if you have essay format exams, then I really suggest using the quiz and recall method that Cal Newport talks about in his Red Book. I believe it's called How to Be a Straight A Student or something like that. The quiz and recall method is very good for that. Even just if you, let's say, make a Feynman for the particular class, or you just sort of say, I'm going to walk through and explain things out loud, all of these concepts to myself, that's a good feedback mechanism, because if you're really struggling to explain it out loud to yourself, then there's a good chance that you don't understand it. So that's a good way of avoiding that problem. So I'm planning to study vocabulary words for the GRE, and I would like to use a combination of metaphors and mnemonics. Do you have a preferred rate, frequency of space repetition for testing? I don't have a particular system for space repetition because, as I mentioned earlier, the time in which that I've had to use systems like that for learning, where you have to do a lot of memorization, has only been once or twice. So I've used fairly simple systems, which I discuss in the course. But if you are doing a lot of it, and you really need to understand it, then the Anki software is probably a good bet for learning it. So Anki, A-N-K-I, is a software that does spaced repetition. And so if you, it automatically, using a more sophisticated algorithm than you could probably come up with on your own, it automatically tries to show you words or subject matter right when it thinks you're about to forget it, which is the ideal time to be reminded of an idea. So if you are doing a lot of that, I would suggest using something like Anki, and again, using the mnemonic systems that that I talk both in my course and in others. What are some good test-taking tips for tests that are challenging and time-pressured? So what I generally suggest for test-taking, and this isn't a big part of the course, but what I generally suggest for test-taking is do practice tests first. because that's probably the best way you'll identify a good test-taking strategy. Sometimes that's not possible, but if you know, for example, okay, this is roughly how the questions work, and you're used to doing the test, then nothing can sort of compensate for that experience. So that would be the best thing to do, is to do practice tests. The other thing to do would be to have a real structure for it. So if you have a structure for the test that you're going to be doing, so you know, okay, well, I'm going to start by reading all the questions, then I'm going to start by answering the easiest one, and I'm going to set a particular time limit for any question so I don't get bogged down. That's a good structure to use. But the kind of structure you should be using, that's easiest to figure out once you already know what the tests look like. All right. There's quite a few other responses, so I'm going to leave some of them now because I want to have some time to do some one-on-one coaching via voice, and then when we have some more time, I'll be able to do it. So if you are interested in doing the live coaching part and you have a microphone and you want to participate, then just click the hand raise button right now, and I will try to go through some of you. And in the meantime, I'll continue answering questions. But if you are interested in, you know, you have a microphone and you would like to come on and discuss things, then you can come on. So, okay. Melissa, are you there?
Hello?
Melissa, yeah?
Yeah, hey.
Hey. Great, so why don't you just briefly explain your situation and what you'd like help with?
Okay, so, I don't know if anyone's ever gone through this before with organic chemistry, but I'm kind of doing everything that they're telling me not to, but I'm only doing that because I was like constrained for time. So I like just memorized all these reaction mechanisms without really understanding it, and now I'm kind of stuck in that like terrible zone where you're not really learning things, but you're taking so much time. And
right.
You're just like forgetting everything that happened.
I think, so my advice in terms of organic chemistry is probably going to be, I'm just going to mute your mic because I'm coming in on the other side. My advice for organic chemistry, and I just muted your mic, Melissa, just because it seems to be getting a bit of feedback here. My advice is probably not going to be the most detailed it could be because I haven't done as much chemistry as a lot of other students, so I sort of rely on kind of what they tell me about the courses. But in general, I found that doing a combination of using metaphors and visualizations to kind of take the, because a lot of chemistry is a lot of abstract symbols and really complicated sounding names, which are very abstract and hard to attach your mind onto. And so if you can develop a system to start organizing those in a more concrete way, so you start visualizing certain chemical compounds as, you know, just associating them with being different colors or different sensory experiences, then if you do that in a consistent way, then that greatly reduces the burden of memorization component. And then, so that's the first part, that in chemistry you have to kind of, there is some things that you just sort of have to memorize because lots of sort of details and different patterns. But there are also a lot of principles. So there are also a lot of places where the Feynman technique is really useful. So I can't speak from too much experience on chemistry, but I know that from what I have done, that is how I have tackled it, is that you want to approach it by using this, sort of this combination of those two approaches. And of course, another thing that's very worth doing if you are in chemistry is look at people who are doing scoring at the top of your class, maybe people who have studied it before, your TAs, for example, if they're, you know, if they did really well in chemistry, go up to them and ask them what were the studying techniques they used? What did they focus on in order to do well in chemistry? And then that can also inform your method maybe a little bit more in more detail than I can provide. So, okay, we have Gilbert Yang. Gilbert Yang, are you there?
Yeah, is this working?
Yeah. So what's the issue you're working through right now?
I just asked a more general question and not, you know, specifically related to what I'm facing. But generally when I really go through the practice phase of what you're describing, and I'm doing practice problems, I don't know how long to stay on a certain problem that I'm stuck on. I don't know, you've probably taken some group classes in mathematics, but you're taking a class, you know, on real analysis or
right.
Something like that. You know, a simple question could take you, you know, hours and 3 days to do. And I don't know, I tend to give up a lot and just look at the answer. And I'd like to know what you, you know, what your thoughts are on balancing, not giving up, and, you know, looking for different ways to find the answer versus giving up and like, seeing the connection.
Right, so it is a tough thing to do. I'm also going to mute the mic. There's some feedback coming through here. It is a tough question. You're asking about proof-based classes. How do you decide how long do you stick through with the problem? Or even just generally in classes, how long do you decide, okay, I'm stuck with this, let's go to the answer. And I found in general the longer you can push through on hard problems, the better, because that's teaching you kind of a different sort of problem-solving skill. So I think that it depends on which stage you're at with your learning. So if you're at a point in your understanding of an idea where you are still very, very much, you do not understand the course, you would only be scoring under 50% on all the problems, that is a point when you want to be doing the questions. I would say spending a little bit less time on each question, because you want to just cover the practice questions so you can figure out, okay, these are the areas that I need to go back and use insight building techniques like the Feynman technique. If you're past that, if you're sort of, I would say, in the 80% plus range, you're getting most of the questions right, but you're occasionally getting stuck, then it's probably better to push longer on a particular question, because even if you can't solve it, you're building the kind of problem-solving grit that you need to solve new problems in that field. So particularly with proof-based mathematical classes, I found that it was almost never a waste of time to spend more time working on a problem, assuming again that I understood the fundamentals. If I didn't understand the fundamentals, then spending a little bit less time and working on insight building techniques are probably better. But I would say if you're kind of already getting most of the questions right, but there's some questions that you're not getting right, then I would always lean towards the side of spending more time on a problem than less. So kind of work until you get so frustrated that you have to give up on it, or you're just running around in circles, you don't have any new ideas. That would be sort of roughly my idea. So we also have another question here. How can metaphors and analogies and simplifications help you build insight? I can see how they can make remembering concepts a lot easier, but how does it prepare you for type of question exam that you haven't ever seen before? So it depends. So I would say that metaphors and analogies and simplification, they're part of a process of uncovering the deep structure of the idea. So in order to create an analogy, you need to sort of understand how the idea works. You need to understand it, and I would say in a less superficial way. You need to have a deeper understanding of it. So perhaps the metaphor is more of a memory tool itself, but the process of generating the metaphor is what creates a lot of the understanding. So if you're using the Feynman technique and you're using metaphors and visualizations, then for example, to visualize a math formula, that is impossible to do. It's impossible to do it correctly if you don't at least understand how the formula works. So it's sort of also a tool to force you to kind of recognize what the deep structure of the idea is. And getting it also in a more intuitive way, getting that sort of metaphor and analogy, that is also useful because it gives you a greater fluency with the idea. If you only understand an idea or you've only seen the deep structure from one angle, one perspective, then you have a certain inflexibility with the knowledge. You can only really use it in one or two ways. Whereas if you've seen it from 10, 20, 30 angles, if you've seen the idea from a lot of different vantage points, then you really have a lot more power there. How much time did you commit to the MIT Challenge every day when you were doing it? When I started, I was doing about 12 hours per day. I don't recommend that. That was hell. But that was what I did when I started it. And then near to the end, I was doing closer to about, I would say, six to eight hours a day. So six to eight hours a day is probably, for me, if I'm not under incredible time constraints, is, I would say, my optimal learning time. I can push 8 to 10, but doing 12 hours a day for the first 3 months was very draining. Do you set a time limit when doing your task, or just carry on working until you complete the task? Depends on what the task is. Generally, I just carry on working until I complete the task. I know that you can set a time limit as part of a time boxing technique. So as a productivity technique to sort of avoid procrastination is you just say, well, I'm only going to work on this for half an hour, so it's easier to get started. But if you aren't procrastinating, if you're actually getting your ideas done, then I tend not to set a time limit. I think the only time I would set a time limit is if, you know, I have to manage myself across several different things that are of equal importance. Were there certain hours of the day that you found yourself more energetic, able to complete uninterrupted study? If so, how do you go about determining these time chunks? Well, I think the only way you can determine is through trial and error. So for me, my best studying hours were from about 10 o'clock to about 2 p.m. So sort of like, you know, right around lunch before and after. By about 3 p.m. and after, I would already be sort of winding down mentally. And usually for the first hour or so, I would still not really be in the flow of things. But that's just for me. I know a lot of other people that, you know, they do some of their best studying at 2 a.m. So you have to figure out what works for you. It's just important that you do it in a sustainable way. So if your best studying is at 2 a.m., but you're only getting 4 hours of sleep because you have classes at 8, you need to find some way around that. What recommendations do you have for people interested in more subjective courses? So graphic design, creative writing, art. The technical aspects can be learned, but how do you become a better artist, writer, or with the subjective skills with the techniques you suggested? So I have not covered this in the beginning part, the month one content, but later in the course I covered deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is this idea of how you would get better at these kind of skills. So if you want to get better at them, my general suggestion is that any skill that you can think of like this, like graphic design, creative writing, art, they're actually not one skill. They're actually probably about 100 or 150 micro skills. So for example, being a good writer is about, you know, having good vocabulary. It's about telling good stories. It's about having good research. It's about having good structure for the ideas. Often it's about mastering a particular type of structure. So Malcolm Gladwell is very famous for a particular style that he writes his books. So your style is in and of itself a little bit of a micro skill that you're working on. And so if you want to improve your skills, it often helps to, first of all, break down the skill into a bunch of different micro skills and then deliberately practice these. And so I cover more deliberate practice later in the course, but if you're interested, I believe I covered the concept of deliberate practice on day 4, I believe, of the boot camp. So if you go there and reread that article, it kind of covers a method for doing that. How will you spend many hours doing work when you have serious emotional things in your mind? And I agree, this is very difficult. If you are dealing with, you know, some stresses in your life, that will seriously impact your productivity. I would say my main point of attack for that is that you want to try to handle the emotional problems in your life instead of just, you know, how do I push those out of the way? And I think one way you can do that is, aside from directly dealing with whatever might be causing the issue, I know that when I didn't have that much control and I wasn't able to change a lot of the emotional problems that were maybe afflicting my life, things like meditation and things like deep relaxation, that can at least kind of settle those stresses. And if you can find yourself in a peaceful and quiet environment, then sometimes you can work through them. Does individual intelligence factor into your methods? What if some of us are not as bright as others? I completely agree that intelligence matters and that some people will have more natural intelligence than others. That is almost an undisputed fact of psychology, so I'm not going to deny that. But what I am going to say is that there is a lot of evidence that the way people learn, so how you learn better, is not different from different people. So these kinds of techniques that I'm talking about, where you are learning via making things more concrete, by trying to understand things more deeply, these are techniques that will work for people who struggle more. They just won't be able to apply them at maybe with necessarily the greatest speed or with the greatest efficiency that someone who is incredibly intelligent will. So I don't think that there's much you can do about that, but I do think that the techniques work very well. How do I take notes when I do online reading? I don't take a lot of notes when I'm doing online reading because the articles tend to be fairly short. So if it's something that I found interesting, then I usually I'm able to compartmentalize it a little bit more. I find that note-taking when I'm reading is more important for books because you have to sustain your concentration a lot longer. So maybe for really long articles, you know, like New York Times type articles, I might use a note-taking technique, and then you could use something like Evernote, or you could use, just keep a Word document open where you're writing down your own notes while you're reading it. But I would say in general for the 1,000 to 2,000 word articles that only take about 10 minutes to read, that's usually something I can sustain the concentration for. And so I'd rather not have the extra sort of environmental difficulty of taking notes. Chad Duncan asks, how do you know when you have studied enough? So that's a good question, and that goes directly to the second part of the MIT method, which is practice. So you know you've studied enough when you are able to successfully execute your goals. So if you want to be able to pass an exam and complete the projects, then you will know you're doing well when you are getting all the practice problems right. If you're in a non-technical class, then you will know you're doing well when your feedback is telling you, yes, you're getting most of these questions right. So that's also a really big reason that you'd want to do a lot of practice. I find that when I really try to deeply understand something, it takes me a lot of time and I get behind, often without deeply understanding the concept. So getting to a deep understanding can take more time. So I'm not saying that it's not necessarily the fastest approach all the time. That's why I recommend doing this pyramid. So if you do the coverage first and then the practice problems and then the insight building stages, then you know that you're sort of only pointing the Feynman technique or these things as a laser on the areas where it's going to be most effective. As you get better at the techniques, you will get faster with them. But when I first started doing Feynman techniques, it would take me up to an hour to do one well in the beginning. And then later on, I could do them almost spontaneously. I could do a couple in an hour. So that was definitely a speed improvement just through having more practice with it. I think that part of the difficulty when you are not really connecting with the idea, you're not really deeply understanding it. Sometimes that can happen when you're not really debugging the idea. So you're creating a lot of connections, but you're not really checking which of those connections are accurate. So I talk about that a little bit more in further editions of Learning on Steroids, the further months of Learning on Steroids. I talk about this debugging phase. So it's not just enough to create a lot of metaphors. You also need to understand where they apply and where they don't, because that's part of recognizing the structure of ideas and also remembering it deeply. So sometimes that's a place where people can go wrong, is they just create a lot of metaphors, but they haven't debugged any of them, so a lot of their connections aren't really good connections. What's the best way to take notes during a lecture in college? So I don't know whether it's in the first month, but I discuss flow-based note-taking. If it's not in the first month, it's definitely in the second month. Flow-based note-taking, that's the method that I used the entire time I was in university and also for the entire time I was doing the MIT challenge. So it's really the method that I recommend. If you have access to professors' TAs, then how could one best use these resources in obtaining a better understanding? Could you tie this with coverage, practice, insight, idea? Okay, so if you have access to people who can help you, that's a huge resource and you should be using it. And I think the best way to do it, and I think the way in which professors and TAs will most want to help you, is when they know that you've put in a lot of work. And so a lot of students just go up to the professor and the TA and they haven't given a single thought to try to understand the ideas on their own, and they just say, hey, I don't understand this, can you explain this to me? And if you have a good professor, they might want to help, but sometimes they might be kind of fed up with that. You know, you might be there for office hours, they might be kind of tired of dealing with this. Whereas if you spend a lot of time trying to build your own insight, then you can narrow down to the specific, very, very specific questions that you don't understand. So if you do the Feynman technique and you laboriously explain an idea to yourself, you might understand, okay, well, there's this little hook that I don't understand. And then you go to the TA or the professor, they can help you with it, and that's much more efficient than just you starting out by saying, you know, I know you only have 20 minutes that you can spend with me, but let's just start from scratch. I think that's probably the most efficient way to do it, as sort of an extra layer on top of the pyramid above insight. So coverage, practice, insight, tutoring might be the other approach you could use. So a lot of professors recommend pre-reading material before attending a lecture. I'm not convinced this is actually an efficient way to retain information. I don't do pre-reading. I know why professors recommend it, because professors, they're teaching one or two classes and they want you to do really, really well. They don't understand that you have to juggle other commitments. And also they want, you know, you to be able to follow accurately in the class. I would say that that's... it's often a waste of time. If you're not doing something where they're going to be calling on you to participate, I generally didn't do pre-reading when I was in university. Often it's better, as I said, the coverage phase doesn't matter as much, so I try to go through it without a lot of waste. So when I was doing the MIT Challenge, if it had lecture videos, then I generally wouldn't also read the textbook, because that's just wasteful. It's better to reread the textbook or reread lectures specifically where I don't understand an idea as part of the insight phase, rather than just doing it twice in every single case. That's not really very efficient. How would you best address loss of motivation, and especially in reference to updating your study skills? So motivation is that's a tricky beast. I think that motivation in a large part is about a process of selling yourself on doing something. And that's a skill in and of itself. Just as it's a skill to sell a product or sell something to a different person, it's also a skill to motivate yourself. And so I would say that if you are having trouble with motivation, then I think you want to... This is a habit that I maintained in the past, and it might be useful to you, is just spending a couple hours every week or every 2 weeks on the weekend just to go through your goals for your life or for the goals that you're working on right now, and really deeply sort of visualize what you want to have happen with them, what the benefits you want to have from your life. And maybe it's a little bit of a self-help cliche to do something like this, but I did find that it did increase my motivation a lot to pursue them. So if that is something you're struggling with, then actually spending time thinking about, well, why am I even working on these study skills? What's the benefit? What do I want from my life? What do I want from my lifestyle? Asking yourself those questions, getting yourself in that mental state, reminds you, right, I'm learning these study skills so that I can spend less time studying, or I can get into the master's program I want, or I can, you know, get and work in the field that I want to work in. When you remind yourself of those things, I think that it removes a lot of the lack of motivation you might have. What are some effective steps to take when you are faced with difficult and time-consuming homework? Again, that's more of a time management criteria. So if you have a lot of homework you have to do, then the best idea I can say is what I recommend to the last person: set aside dedicated time where you will not have interruptions. And even if you have to be a bit of a jerk to people around you and say, look, I'm going to be working on this from the hours of 8 a.m. to 12. Can you not interrupt me? And turn off your phone, turn off your computer, and just work on it. Because I think a lot of people I know, they say, oh, I have difficult and time-consuming homework, but they rarely put this focused time into it. And you can get a lot done if you just say, 4 hours, I'm going to do that and nothing else. What is one piece of advice that you offer that people never seem to take? This is a funny question. Thanks, Michelle. I like this because I feel a lot of my advice people don't take, and that's often on my challenge as well, that I try to make my advice as actionable as possible. So if I'm suggesting advice that people don't seem to take, then maybe it's because they recognize that the advice is more difficult to apply than I'm making it seem. I think that the advice that people are less willing to apply are the counterintuitive advice. So the things that make you feel like you're doing the wrong thing, but it's actually the right thing. So an example of that is restricting your working hours. That's something a lot of people have difficulty applying because it's counterintuitive. People think, oh, well, you know, I want to be more productive. I can't risk doing that. I can't risk cutting my hours. Or I also had the same problem with weekly daily goals. When I recommend it to people, the idea that when you finished your goals that you're done working, and that not only you should do that, but you should also set goals lists that you can actually achieve, that they're not just filled with, you know, everything you'd like to do, but things that you can reasonably accomplish in one day. People have difficulty adjusting to that. And I think that's more of a mental block than anything else. Should I work on insight during a lecture instruction? No. coverage, if you're going to do coverage, you can work on those kind of ideas. You can work on creating metaphors. You can work on that. But that's all depending on how difficult it is to keep up. Both practice and insight are intended to take place outside of the classroom setting most of the time. You know, there might be a class that's very easy that you can do it in the same class, but I would say if the class is a difficult class, you won't be able to do that. When self-educating, how do you determine when you should move on to the next material when taking a class? Assuming you are following coverage practice and insight process that you suggested. Okay, so there's two ways you can think about this. So the first way you can think about this is how I use it myself, is what I call the 70% rule. And this is just that the way I think about self-education is it's not about, and this is how I often practice it, is that for me, I want to learn way more than I have time to learn. And so what I try to do is I want to understand it to 70% and then I want to move on. And I'm not too worried about this. I know this sometimes contradicts the way other people feel about learning. I'm not too worried about this because I know if the idea is important, I will come back to it and I will, you know, increase that 70%. So that's how I look at it. If you are self-educating for a concrete goal, like you want to do something in particular, then you use that as your evaluation criteria. So when I was doing the MIT challenge, my evaluation criteria of when I have learned enough is when I am able to score the grades that I wanted on a particular practice exam or practice assignments. So if you have a concrete goal to work for, then use feedback as, are you hitting your goal? If you're not hitting your goal, you need to work more on it. That's pretty simple. What was your diet like during the MIT challenge? And you prepare meals ahead of time? What was the most energizing food? I think diet and health are important. But they are peripheral issues. They're not central issues. So if you have not mastered a productivity system, if you have not mastered a learning technique, then by all means, working on your diet and your health and your exercise is going to be good for your life. But I don't think that the benefits are more indirect. So what I was eating during the MIT challenge, I didn't have a great diet during the MIT challenge. I was eating things primarily that didn't take a long time to cook. How do you push through the fear of doing things wrong, i.e. pronunciation in language learning? So there's two ways you can do that. One is try to find an environment that will be non-threatening. So when I was learning public speaking, I joined Toastmasters. Toastmasters, they are the nicest, well, they tend to be the nicest people ever. If you do a horrible job as a speech, they will still applaud you at the end and give you compliments and also give you some constructive criticism. They're not just sycophantic. But at the same time, that is a big part. If you are in an environment that is non-threatening, then you can explore it. So if you're looking on language learning, then consider even just hiring someone who can help you speak and help you with pronunciation. Or do something like LiveMocha. You can go livemocha.com. It's a website where you can find native speakers and speak to them online. So being in a situation like that, and the second thing is you just kind of have to start doing it. I know whenever I go back to France or ever I start speaking French again, there's always that hesitancy, that little bit of poor fluency at the start where I've forgotten a lot of this, I don't feel comfortable doing this. And what I did is you just push through that, and after you've done it once or twice, then it's good again. So, how do you spread out your review study time and prevent studying only the day before? If you have assignments popping out during the test week, which hinders you from setting some time to review, what would you do? If the teacher is still teaching new concepts for 2 or 3 days before a test, what is a good way to review those concepts in such a short time? So I think the mistake a lot of students make is that they sort of follow the approach I was saying before, where they're doing the MIT method, which is coverage, practice, and insight, but they're doing the practice and insight like all in the week before the exam, which is terrible. It's a terrible idea to do that. And so what's a much better idea is to actually just master ideas as they come at you in a class. And that was the reasoning behind the learn it once principle that I developed early on in the course. I've moved away from it a little bit because I found that, you know, there's situations where it doesn't apply. But at least in the classroom setting, if you're given an idea in a class, just master it then. Don't wait until, you know, you move on to the next section of the next lecture or the following chapter. That can be a good idea in self-education, but when, you know, you're already committed to spending 4 months learning the idea through lectures, then it doesn't make sense to do that. Does listening to music while working distract you? I don't listen to music when I'm learning or even doing anything that's remotely a mental task. But that's also just me. I function very poorly with distractions there. So you have to figure out what works for you. In terms of holistic learning, how do you connect ideas between different areas? And by that I mean make it a conscious attempt, or is it a subconscious? And that, oh, that makes sense, reminds me of an analogy in this area. I would say it's more the second thing. So I don't say, okay, let's connect differential equations with baking. I don't think of it in that way. Like, I don't try to force that connection. But if I do create, you know, just, okay, let's try to understand differential equations, and you're thinking, okay, what is differential equations like? Well, it's a bit like this, and then that triggers an analogy. That would be the best way to do it. I would say the way you get more creative analogies is often by simplifying. So if you're trying to figure out, well, how do I connect these very two different topics? Don't force that. Just try to explain whatever abstract topic you're doing and try to explain it in a simpler way, because by simplifying, you will end up making these kind of connections naturally. So I do have time for one more question. So if anybody wants to write a question, there we can do that. Just in general, thank you guys for coming to the workshop. I really appreciate it. I know that it's, you know, you're taking time out of your evening or your morning, depending where you are, to listen to me talk about learning and these ideas. And I really appreciate also all the people who have signed up for Learning on Steroids, that have started their 30-day trials, that have started using these techniques, because as much as I enjoy working on this, I really enjoy seeing you guys implement the ideas and seeing you guys learn more with them. So that seems to be it for the questions. Again, thank you guys for coming. I'm going to try to make a recording of this available. If you have any questions, if there's anything that I've missed, if there's something that you wanted to ask and I didn't get a chance to answer it in the workshop, then please send me an email, because I don't always have time to spend a long time replying to emails, but I do always read them, and I would like to try to respond to them if I can. So thank you for coming, and I will hope to talk to you all again soon.